Welcome to The Limits. I'm Jay Williams.
What's going to happen?
Let me paint a picture for you. I'm in a beautiful atelier in Harlem, surrounded by red velvet couches, gleaming wooden floors, and very high-end clothes.
Nah, I know.
Vada? Yeah.
Get that Come strong this side. Way. I'm this cool. Way. I'm cool.
Remember I told you this way. Always get these people.
This is none other than Harlem native and fashion icon, Dapper Dan, or Dap as I call him. He and I are about to sit down for a video interview, and he can't help but direct the shot himself.
And she's the director, huh?
Yes.
The NPR crew is trying to get pictures of Dap and me, but Dap wants to make sure we get pictures of everybody, including the crew themselves.
Make sure you get her, man, so young girls in Harlem will know the positions we hold behind the camera. You understand? Mm-hmm. I always tell them.
If you don't already know who Dapper Dan is, you maybe just got a slice of several things that make this man tick. He's a visionary and a scholar. He's a designer who's been in the game for over 5 decades, and he cares as much about today's aesthetics as he does about the history behind them. He understands deeply the importance of representation across generations and industries. That's why he needs you to know that Black and brown people were making things happen behind the scenes on the set today. And Dap, he always makes sure that things go down right here in Harlem. Here are some of the milestones in this 77-year-old legend's life. He was a gambling prodigy, earning thousands of dollars as a kid in the 1950s. He got involved with drugs as a teenager and briefly went to prison and came out with a newfound respect for Black culture and sensibilities. He poured the sights and sounds of Harlem Corners into his clothing and opened his namesake store in 1982. You see, he saw the potential of logomania early on and repurposed luxury brands like Louis Vuitton and Gucci with his own vision. He started out dressing gangsters and hustlers and then went on to dress hip-hop greats like Eric B., Rakim, LL Cool J, and Salt-N-Pepa. And when the FBI shut his store down in the 90s, he disappeared from the public eye for some time. But a few years ago, Dap got a shot at a Gucci partnership and one of life's greatest ironies. We'll get into that and more. With Dap, though, it's always a deep dive into history, from life in Harlem after the Great Migration to how rock and roll and jazz informed contemporary hip-hop culture. Quoting Malcolm X, Dap says, if you want to understand the flower, you got to study the seed. Also, today's a big day at The Limits. We're putting full-on video episodes on NPR's YouTube channel to go along with the pod moving forward. And trust me, you don't want to miss out on seeing Dap's atelier and designs. So let's get to it. Here's my conversation with the legend, the great Dapper Dan. Before I came here, I had to read an excerpt from the Emancipation Proclamation.
Okay.
For our morning edition, right? And since we're coming off Juneteenth, one of the things I found very interesting to hear your perspective on. Your father was born 35 years after the Emancipation Proclamation was signed, right?
Yes.
How have you seen where we are now compared? I mean, that was such a short time ago. How do you envision that process since we've been there? Because it's very close.
Yes. What I realized after studying my father and coming out, like walking away from the Corners and going back to school at the age of 23, I was fortunate enough to come into contact, because I was writing for a radical student newspaper called 40 Acres and the Mule in 1968. And at that time, we had Black scholars constantly coming in and out, you know, to the news editorial board to talk to us. And one of the most impressive ones that I spoke to was Dr. Henry Clark. And Dr. Henry Clark says to me that, said to all of us, when a student asks him, he said, well, if we're the original people on the planet, why are we going through today what we're going through, you know? And Dr. Henry Clark's answer was, that's because of a transgression that we made against ourselves before Europeans came into our life. So that changed the whole perspective on how I saw the world. After that, and that was 1968, I had an option to either accept an internship leading to a scholarship to go to Columbia University or do a 7-nation tour in Africa. So because of what Dr. Henry Clark said, I had to find out exactly what he meant because he didn't elaborate. So I chose to go to Africa on a living, no hotels, on a living, living with families and everything. When I came back from Africa, one of the interesting things when over there, I asked the African, I said, do you think every day about the fact that you're Black? And he said, I never think about that. You see, I never think about that. And I like went to bed that night thinking, wow, we think about that every day, consciously or subconsciously.
Yes.
Every single day. We walk down the subway, we encounter somebody.
And Dap always reminded of it, too.
We're always reminded of it. And then when I start reflecting on my father, I said, wow. When my father came up during the Great Migration at 12 years old, I never heard him complain. You know, all he did was what he needed to do. And I said, oh, that's what it is. I'm not going to be complaining. I'm going to do what I have to do to make my way through the system.
First off, to understand how to navigate the system, you have to understand the system, right? Mm-hmm. That's first and foremost.
Yes.
But as you were being raised during that time, and let's go back before you even went to Africa, before you were able to discover what Henry Clark was talking about, your first awareness around civil rights and activism, like what were your first experiences with that? Did that set you on that journey towards discovery?
Know what set me on this journey? I read Malcolm, and Malcolm said, if you want to understand the flower, study the seed. And so everything I wanted to know about life, about business, about anything, I would always go back and see where it came from. That's why I went to Africa in 1968.
Let's talk about Harlem for a second. We're here now. We're at your spot. Incredible boutique downstairs. Provide some descriptive color for me about how Harlem was during your time being raised here.
Harlem was amazing. If you look at Harlem now, the ethnic breakdown that you see in Harlem now is the exact same ethnic breakdown that I saw, but just a little more white people. But the difference is, the economical difference is, the social status is different. Growing up in Harlem when I was born, we had poor Irish, poor Jews, poor Greeks, poor Italians. We were all here together. So that was the Harlem. In fact, that was a community that will never be seen in the world again. And that's the Harlem that I grew up with.
You know, it wasn't a race thing. It was an economic thing.
It was economical thing. So we were smashed together. It was a gumbo here in Harlem, you know. So that's what it was like. And we learned from each other, you know. And I slowly saw, growing up in the 50s in an elementary school, and then by the time I got to high school, they had all managed to get the Italians, the Greeks, you know, and all of them made it out. You know, they made it into the melting pot. So Harlem changed. But the biggest thing that changed Harlem was not so much the middle class that the whites leaving, it was the middle class blacks leaving. Because when in the 50s, right, you had redlining, right, and segregation. So the middle class blacks was forced to be here with the rest of us. You know, but when banks started allowing blacks to move into the other suburban community, and whites was more open to that, you know what I mean? There was all the middle class blacks left. Like you hear stories about Sugar Hill. Sugar Hill had the sugar on it. Those were sugar sweet black middle class people living on Sugar Hill.
Man. Miles Davis people.
Yeah,
like that,
and when
right?
we went to church, we went to church with middle class blacks and stuff. And then they all left. They left, and then. Then we no longer saw stars. We no longer saw those images. And then coupled with that, the drug epidemic hit in the 60s, and that destabilized us. That was the final nail in the coffin to take Harlem downhill.
So the educational component in the 50s, since the middle class was, everybody was grouped together, I mean, that's the trickle down of how everybody was raised and rose together as a collective one. But you remove that middle class,
yes.
And it's about survival.
That's right. Exactly. And it's about the absence of images.
Yeah.
And interaction.
You know, Dap, I'm 40 years old. I grew up, my dad worked at American Express. First black executive I ever saw was a guy named Ken Chenault. Ran American Express. I often think about how fortunate I was to have a dad that I saw him achieve that it let me know at a very young age, well, I can do anything. And I think about my child who's 4 growing up having a black president. It's just part of the fabric, the DNA. Since I found out we were going to be doing this interview, I spent a lot of time thinking about how do you create a vision when there's not a vision for you to actually see? Like you have to imagine it. You have to dream it.
My father only went to the 3rd grade. And when he came up here, he left at 12 years old. Never saw his family again. He came from Emporia, Virginia, a little town, tiny town, 6,000, I studied it, 6,000, population 6,000 when he left Emporia, Virginia, and he came up here. And in studying him and what he went through and never went back and had to teach himself how to read so that he can pass the civil service exam to get a job working for the housing authority, I said, oh, there it is. So I put all these elements together, you know. But the overall thing, the biggest lesson I learned from looking at those people who made it, the difference between those who made it and my father is that I learned from my father how to fail and succeed. And that's something I didn't learn from successful people, because when I looked at successful people, you know, they know how to do good, but they don't know how to do bad.
Or you just don't have access to all the bad because you see the good.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm saying in the event that you go down, I've seen what it looks like now. You know, even now, the choices that I made, I say, this system can't break me because, you know, what they consider doing bad is normal for me. You know, they can't threaten me with not having anything because I grew up not having anything. You know what I'm saying? So I notice a lot of people get broke doing that.
Damn, that's so it's because... It feels like there's so many opportunities for people these days, but there's not that kind of mentality that my back is against the wall. I have no other choice but to make it. But the beautiful opportunity is that you do have opportunities, right? So how do you see, and I don't mean to jump ahead, but I am curious where you see the rest of the world as it relates to that same drive, that ambition. Because I feel it from the moment you walked in this room. I want to pinpoint where we are and how we're moving forward, but there's a direction, there's an ambition there.
And thank you for answering that, because it's vision. You have to see it, and that's what I tell them all the time. Everywhere we go, I tell them, take pictures of the people behind the scene, because young black and brown people in Harlem, they don't get to see productive people except for the ones who are being interviewed. You follow me? So I'd like them to take pictures of everybody, everywhere, in all our positions, wherever we go, so that they can see that. So I knew that I grew up in Harlem. I saw the stars. I saw the educators. I saw all that. But when they vanished, there was no images for them to see. So I know how important images to see. The public school that I went to, Langston Hughes, lived right across the street. You know? And I'm reading poems by Langston Hughes. Who was the first borough president? Hewlin Jack, the first black borough president, came to our school and speak. You know what I mean? 131st Street was where James Baldwin lived, you know? I saw all these things. These young people today don't see that. So I want these visions, I want them to be able to see these things. I want to be able to talk about these things. That's why I never left Harlem. No matter what, I'm not leaving Harlem because I know how important it is for them to see me. Young kids saw me on the train the other day. They said, Dapper Dan, damn, I never thought I'd see you on the train. I said, son, I'm on the train so that I can see you. You know what I'm saying? Because I know what it is to see somebody who can transition from where they are.
Langston Hughes, James Baldwin, Malcolm X. Damn, I told you, this man has our history coursing through his veins. After the break, we hear how getting locked up unlocked his plans for the future. This is The Limits from NPR. I'm Jay Williams. Stay with us. Dapper Dan has his pulse on the past, present, and future. He always seems to know how to transform what's going on into what's going to be happening next. That's as true with culture at large as it is in his own life. And when he spent a stint in prison for selling drugs as a teenager, Dap was listening and preparing for his next moves.
You got to look at the time. It was during the 60s, you know, and it was June 19th. I forget, like yesterday, June 19th. 1967, I got it out September 27, 1967, and I went right back to school. But now the penitentiaries, they make it impossible for you to get drugs while you're in there, and gangs, they're letting the gangs proliferate. So it's a lot of issues now that wasn't there, you know? You know, during the 60s, was a lot of revolution, you know? It was a change in the music. You had the Sound of Philadelphia and all. And Berry Gordy allowed the musicians to change the platform when he had Marvin Gaye saying, what's going on? You know what I mean? That shift, that philosophical shift for people of color made a big difference for us young guys, you know? Mm-hmm. Wake up everybody, you know more? No more sleep in bed.
Everybody.
You know,
yeah.
All that, what's going on? And that's, and that, all of that, that whole thing, James Brown saying, saying is, you know, say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud. We don't have that today. You know, we don't have a strong enough voice for that today. A lot of people complain today about drill music, you know, and they have no counter offense for that. You know, but we had a counter offense for that. We had people singing about, we had a powerful voice, like, moving on up, you know? Mm. So that's what made the difference, you know?
Take me back to 1982, when you opened this boutique, man. Yeah. Describe to me what it was like in this community, how you were like in that the high-end boutique fashion industry when you opened up here.
I was living in a closed, locked social status. When you study my story, you see, I catered only to gangsters and hustlers. The reason being is I wasn't accepted by middle-class blacks. They didn't understand what I was doing. You know what I mean? They didn't understand it.
Why do you think that was?
Because I think they were fixated on vertical mobility, that they didn't look around and see what was going on. You know what I mean? When you go back into the 80s, when I was doing all this in 1987, there was only one, the European publication was the first ones that recognized me. And then from there, all these other people started recognizing me, all these European magazines and fashion magazines. Middle-class blacks didn't see me. I got honored by Ebony 2 years ago for the first time after 30-something years. You know what I'm saying? So now, I give speaking engagements at FIT, at Parsons, at the Museum of Modern Art, at the Schomburg. I give museums in Africa, in Europe, you know, but I was never recognized. And I don't fault them for it, but we just have to open up our eyes, you know. They saw what I was doing as like, oh, he's just using them, their images. And they have no clue to, this is what history does. We take whatever we are given and we make something out of it. Who came here speaking English? Look at the music. Our music, we export more culture than any other group in the world, African Americans do. People of color in North America and South America export more culture in terms of music and other aspects of culture than any other group. The whole world is watching us.
Take me through Logomania and how you started that.
All the symbols in about America is founded on symbolism. The flag, you know, everything you see, the pyramid on the dollar bill, you know what I'm saying? The eagle with the 13 arrows and the 13 feathers, you know, and the 13 steps in the eye. So I got into symbols early on. And so when I opened up the store, symbolism was already a big part of my life. And a guy came in the store and he had a Louis Vuitton pouch. And it was like, Louis Vuitton pouch is $5 worth of vinyl. Everybody got super excited about that pouch, you know? It was Jack, a big time hustler. And he had $100 bills, and it was fascinating. And I looked at that and I say, they are fascinated, but it's the symbols. It's the symbols. So I thought to myself, damn, if I could have them walking around looking like that pouch, imagine what I could do, you know? So I went to work, going back to what Malcolm says, study, if you want to understand the flower, study, see. So I taught myself everything about textile printing and began to print them symbols and use them in a way that they've never been used before.
How so?
So Rafflerman gave you one horse. Dapper Dan gave you a whole herd, you know?
I love it. You know, there's a slight twist on it, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, more is always, you know, if one is okay, more is always better. Mm-hmm. So I start using, and if you want blues and blacks and grays, which is the European way of, you know, portraying culture, I say, I'm going to give you yellows, peoples, and and pinks, and every color in the rainbow. So that's why you hear me say, so I took symbols and Africanized them or blackenized them. And so that's how this whole thing with Logomania caught on.
Dap, tell me about your first collaboration that really launched you into the next echelon of your success. I mean, some of the hip-hop names of artists that you've been able to collaborate with, from the Eric B to the Rakims to the LL Cool J's, I mean, the it type of people. Tell me how all that came together.
Fortunate for me, I had three older brothers who, and so that enabled me to witness music and three different levels, you know. So my brothers grew up with jazz, and my mother grew up with the blues. I grew up with rock and roll. But I noticed how all these different levels had a different costume, what I call a costume, you know. And the artists would dress different for each musical equation, you know. So I said, oh, and I began to notice. And now my brother and them was fixated on jazz, and their influence was the Rat Pack, Sammy Davis mm-hmm. Jr., you know, Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, you know, that whole crew, and they had their old style. So music, I noticed early on that music, the other side of the coin of music is fashion. Then I saw Miles Davis, you know, when he started playing new jazz, and then he went to a concert and saw punk rock, acid rock, and he was fascinated. He said, man, look at all these people out here. So as he shifted from new jazz to acid rock, so did his wardrobe shift. When the rap artists started coming to the store, I was always, you know, always had knowledge of how this evolves, right? So when they come, I ask them, well, how you want to look? How you want to feel? So they say, I want to look like the Hustlers. So I took them to a new level of that. You know, here's the biggest transformation. The Hustlers in the 50s going into the 60s, they wanted diamonds, furs, alligators, crocodiles, all this stuff. And those are the things I focused on. But when I found out that the symbols could even supersede my ability to make money even more than those things, I said, I needed to develop this, you know? And they needed a new identity. Hip-hop needed its own identity to show that they was big. So a guy would come, he could only afford a sweatsuit, you know? Like Jam Master Jay and Eric B and Rakim, they could afford the whole suit. I took European symbols and blackenized them, you know, and fashioned them in a way. People say, why did you do that? I say, Picasso did the same thing when he went to Africa. And from that there, we got all these different art forms. I say, it has always happened, you know?
Same thing with Elvis. You hear Elvis all the time.
It's a forever thing. We see things, and then we adapt them to the way we want, as a reflection of our culture and who we are. So that's all I did. The same way we talk. You know, in the same way we talk, what we do with language, how we do with song, how we do with everything, is just, you know, reflecting ourselves. So when I opened up my store, I was fully conscious of that. And all the rappers got coming in. And to this day, even right now, I'm doing something from LL Cool J.
So you have all these celebrities rocking Logomania, representing the brand moving forward. And I want to bring you to a day because, you know, when you have logos from Fendi, Louis Vuitton, Gucci, you went through a moment with Fendi raiding your store.
The one with Fendi?
Yeah.
Fendi was an interesting story. Because,
yeah, take me through that.
The lawyer representing Fendi, who was serving me the cease and desist orders. The cease and desist orders means they come, they shut you down, they take anything that you have with their logo on it, and any equipment that you use to make that. That gives them the power to do that, right? And one of the lawyers who was representing that, the key lawyer who was representing that, was she's a justice of the Supreme Court now, Sotomayor. When she came in and she raided the store, right, it was a strange day, because when she came in, she said, wow, look at this. But she commenced the raiding and taking everything. So that was the major raid. I didn't fight that vigorously. Had I fought that vigorously, history would have been changed, because I didn't know at the time, because I wasn't privy to the law concerning trademark. And so they end up litigating against me, and they took everything. Had I known, all I needed to do was go downstairs in City Hall and examine the records. All I had to do is commit. I would, you know, commit to, okay, I made a mistake, I'm sorry. And I could have paid a $5,000 fine. As opposed to that, I lost $250,000.
Wow, you lost $250,000.
That's right. I had a 2,000 square foot factory on 120th Street. And I had a three-story building on 125th Street. And this was loaded with machines. I had 23 Africans sewing, 12 in the daytime and 11 at night for 365 days a year for 9 years straight.
So Dap, did you ever think about, like, while you were putting things in motion and creating this unique product, that, am I doing something wrong here? Or you just, it was, you're so locked into the process that you didn't spend time thinking about that.
I was, you know, I think crime might have been the first thing I learned. You know, crime, the type of crime, that to us, that wasn't even crime. You're taking something that's not tangible. Huh. You know, crime to us was you taking something tangible. You're
taking somebody's life. Yeah, you're doing something.
Goods or something like that. So I never thought of it that way.
Huh. How'd you stay afloat during those rough times, man?
By thinking about my father and what he went through, there's nothing I went through that was greater than the challenge of the first migration, the first great migration came to the South. I saw some horrible living conditions. I was born in the worst neighborhood in Harlem, you know, East Harlem, flat houses. You might look under my sink and yell at your neighbor, you know, rats, roaches, everything.
Dapper Dan was knocked down when he was raided by the authorities, sure. And he was losing money hand over fist. But he remembered who he was and where he came from. The reinvention of Dapper Dan. That's next on The Limits. Stay with us.
Sometimes vultures, you know, you see a vulture coming and the carcass is not dead. So they can't eat.
Dapper Dan did more than survive. He thrived. And by the time 2017 rolled around, he was faced with an interesting situation. Gucci had, to put it generously, borrowed Dap's designs. Many on the internet said they should boycott the brand, but he turned cancel culture into one of the biggest opportunities in his life, taking his career to the next level and moving things forward for all Black creatives.
So take me through this moment in 2017 with Gucci.
Oh, amazing.
Take me through, like, and sometimes I get frustrated at the internet, that, right? Because I think sometimes a lot of the negative things trend instead of seeing the incredible things or the opportunities that come along with it. But there was this inflection point that happened for you with Gucci in 2017. Take me through that process.
Everything that I did in fashion prior to 2017, I never thought I would get credit for. I saw Tom Ford, I saw all of them appropriate the designs and stuff on them. And I had no clue to until Alexander Michelle stood here right by that table back there and said to me, he said, I don't know why everybody's upset with me paying homage to you. He said, all the major houses have Dapper Dan looks on their mood board.
Hmm.
You know, that was like a, wow, that was like a hell of a moment for me.
And then, how did you even respond to that, first off? Huh? It had to be a level of appreciation where you're hearing that, but was there anger? Was there appreciation? What was the feeling?
Well, a lot of people say that because your generation is the generation of expectation. My generation is the generation of, like, it may not happen because they're blocking us. That's the difference, you know? Y'all can expect to happen because y'all seen things happen. My generation, we didn't see nothing happen. Not coming from my level, you know? So your generation is in a generation of expectation. You done seen everybody do everything. You done saw a president and all of that. I ain't see that. Me and my friends grew up, every woman on TV was a maid. Every man was a butler. Bill Cosby was the first one to come on TV that had a role where he was anything other than a butler that we saw.
Hmm.
You feel what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, all my creative things, I didn't think I was going to get credit for it. What changed my life was social media. Social media came along and people could associate what they were seeing with what they heard about or what they saw in Harlem. And that's what made the difference, you know? And so when social media went into an uproar over what Gucci did, I said, oh, wow, I got a voice. I never had a voice before. People are gonna know where it really came from. So that was like, that was a great moment for me, just to see that. But I never expected what happened, what Gucci did would happen though, even in spite of that. But when Gucci decided to say, well, it's only right that we give him his credit, you know? And was strategic as well. But Marco Bizzarri, I think in his brilliance, he fully embraced what it was. You know, this came from Dapper Dan, so let's give him a partnership. you know? And I doubted that. You know, my son said, yeah, man, Gucci is serious. I said, man, yeah, they've been raiding me for 20 years. What do you mean they're serious?
I've read about that. You told them, oh, if they're really serious, tell them to come down here and
yeah,
talk.
Yeah, tell them to come to Harlem. And they came. I say, I tell them, I have to continue to be able to do what I've always done. And they made that possible. So I said, wow, this is that moment. This is that time, you know?
Dab, just tell me the feeling really quickly when Gucci walked into your place.
I have it on film. And they walked together with us from my brownstone to the Apollo Theater. How profound is that, man? Letting everybody in Harlem see him? What kind of, do you imagine that statement?
It's a massive statement.
Yeah. Yeah, that was like, I say, this is serious here, you know? Let me tell you, you think that was powerful. If you look at when I got the Joffrey Beam Award, mm-hmm. and on the Gucci, you can go on the Gucci website. I think Tom Ford and Alexander Michelle were standing together. And Alexander Michelle, the caption on the Gucci website is, "Now the world knows the secret of my garden." You know how powerful that is? That's not on Dapper Dan's IG. That's on Gucci IG. "Now the world knows the secret of my garden," when he's presenting me.
When you see black-owned brands, right, you talk about FUBU, Cross Colors, things of that sort. How do you view sustainability of black-owned luxury brands in this world? The sustainability of it? Like, where are the challenges that come along with it, Dap?
Here's the key. Had they studied the key to what I did, those brands would still be alive today. You know? Or if they studied what brands do today, they would still be here. I think Cross Colors kind of caught on when they knew they were sinking and they went and got Carl Kanai, you know, to reinvigorate them. They kind of caught on, but it was too late. They created an identity that was only suitable for the period, that certain period. You know, they dated themselves. Mm-hmm. All right. What did I do to make me successful? I never allowed myself to get fixed in a certain identity. When every artist that came to me and all my clients came to me, I didn't create solely from myself. I asked them, I looked at their lyrics, I looked at their lifestyle and the message they wanted to bring. And I created from that. So I became every artist. And throughout time, I kept dealing with different artists and representing what they want to say, you know, and how they want to look. For instance, here's an example. Eric B. and Rakim. When you see the jackets that I did for them in the 80s, Rakim has on the back of his jacket the 5% symbol to represent that. So I knew that's who he was, so I represented him that way, but with the same symbols. Eric B. is a swag man, so I represented him with the Gucci on the back with swag that way, right? Then you had Jungle Brothers came. Their rap was and their look was about Afrocentrism. So I had them, I made them outfits in red, green, and black. Boogie Down Production come, and they into Jamaican rap, so I used all the Jamaican colors. So throughout my whole history of creating, I constantly adapted to the artists, you know? So what I like to tell young people is Dapper Dan does not dictate fashion. He translates culture, because all these cultural icons that come along, I give them the look that goes with what they want to do. Hmm. You know, and that's what they didn't do. They made everybody look the same, you know, straight across the board.
Dab, I'm so fascinated by this because you're still going. Obviously, another collaboration with Gap. You're still doing a lot. But I am curious, along your journey, who do you see as upcomers that maybe carry the same swag or vision that you have incorporated into the game?
The closest thing I can see to that is Kirby Jean Raymond. Yeah, because not only is he creating great fashion, but he's making powerful social statements, you know? So other than him, and he speaks truth to power, you know? Because he's in a position where He could be threatened. His career could be threatened, but he's speaking up. You know?
One of the terms I hear people use all the time, and I see it trending on social media all the time, is like hashtag black excellence. Through your upbringing and all your experiences, how does Dapper Dan define black excellence?
I see it as people who commit themselves to something, a cause, or a profession, and through their ability, they take it to levels that it hasn't been taken before, or reach levels that others can't reach. That's what black excellence means to me.
Well, there's no doubt, man, what you've been able to achieve and what you're still achieving and where you're going, that you are you're a visionary and you're part of that success story, man. This has been one of the most incredible learning experiences I've had in my life, just sitting here hearing the knowledge, the history of Harlem, and how you've battled through. Like, you know, this whole show is based upon, it's called The Limits, right? Because I feel like we all have things that can inhibit how we move or how we decide to move, but there's a mentality that you have that is so unique. It's a relentless spirit there. You almost feel like that, in a way, like you were going to be successful regardless of whatever it was in your life, that you had that kind of passion, that kind of drive.
Did you see, I don't know whether you saw the conversation I had on The Breakfast Club.
With Charlamagne Tha God?
Yes.
Yeah. I heard it. Can you do me a quick favor and just recap it for us real quick so they can understand what it was?
Well, I had to explain to young people why it's important to penetrate corporations as opposed to getting mad at what corporations do and walk away. That, you know, everybody in my generation and maybe two or three generations below me understand what that means, because it's how we got where we got. Do you understand what I'm saying? One of the most critical things that happened in the last 3 or 4 years in fashion, as in well in other profession, is the way we formulate cancel culture. Cancel culture is very dangerous if it's not used right. So cancel culture said walk away from Gucci. Statistics show that maybe 3% to 5% of African-American dollars go into these big brands. If we walk away from these brands, we have no leverage to infiltrate these brands. Mm-hmm. So cancel culture say walk away, you know? But history says get in. You follow what I'm saying? And I took a lot of slack for this, you know, and because I said, we should be happy when brands make a mistake, because when they make a mistake, we can step to them and make sure they let us step up, not step off. We gain nothing, right? And so putting in place opportunities in various aspects for blacks to excel within the fashion industry, right?
Not stepping away, stepping in.
Stepping in. That's going to elevate us. You know, when you look back on every historian will tell you, every time it's a war, black people move up because they need us to shoot guns, starting with the Civil War. The people who had the biggest impact on fashion during those crises and the crises that are yet to come are people who are not in part of the fray on an everyday basis. And that's a big problem.
Outsiders who challenge the status quo.
They should have known that. Look, Gucci came and got me. That was so significant as a result of, like, you know, do the right thing. They came and got me. Great. So what did that mean? Louis Vuitton had to go get Virgil. Right? I ask these brands today, and I ask people today, okay, you're gonna make a change. Make sure you come get the next Dapper Dan off the street corner, because that's where it came from. Make sure you come get the next Jay-Z, because what would the culture be like if it didn't start from the corners, if we don't go in the corners? Do you understand what I'm saying? That's the big part of what's happening.
So wait, because I agree with you on this, right? It's not about just penetrating, it's about elevating once you are able to penetrate. How do you balance the delicacy of the vulnerability that some of these old guards, traditional brands still have?
It's self-healing. Let me tell you what it does. It fixes itself. I'm uncomfortable, I'm uncomfortable if I'm broke. You know, that's the bottom line. Yes. So that's why it fixes itself. You get the first people in, and then their competition has to respond to that because it's going to make a difference. So it's self-healing.
So diversity and inclusion just spreading itself.
Yes. You know what I'm saying?
So in a moment of crisis, don't step away. Step in.
That's
step
right.
Step further in.
Yeah.
Dab, I appreciate you for your knowledge. I appreciate you for your time. And thank you so much for today.
Thank you.
It was a game changer. I appreciate you, brother. A big thanks to Dapper Dan's team for letting us do this interview, including a full video shoot at his atelier in Harlem. I got a big lesson in how to make sense of history and one's personal history to gain strength and understanding from it. On this week's episode of The Limits Plus, Dap talks about his childhood heroes and the wisdom he now shares with kids in Harlem. And as always, remember, stay positive and let's keep it moving. The Limits is produced by Devin Schwartz, Mano Sundaresan, and Lena Sunsgiri. Our intern is Daniel Soto. Video production by Kaz Fantone, Langston Sessoms, Christina Shaman, Iman Young, and Nick Michael. Our executive producers are Karen Kinney, Marilyn Williams, and Yolanda Sanguini. Our senior VP of programming and audience development is Anya Grumman. Music by Ramteen Arablouei. Special thanks to Christina Hardy, Rudy Correa, and Charlotte Rigby.